When words are many, transgression is not lacking. What do I mean by that? Stay tuned for this week's Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm the host here on Principles and Policies. And what am I talking about? You may recognize that as a partial biblical verse. I will read the whole thing, and I'm reading from the English Standard Version. The wording is slightly different in many, many, many versions, but it's all has the same meaning. This is Proverbs 10, verse 19. I'm going to also get into verse 18 and verse 20, but we'll start out with verse 19. When words are many, transgression is not lacking, but whoever restrains his lips is prudent. What does that mean? Well, what it means is, essentially, if you have to explain something with lots and lots of, with what we see now in government and with candidates running for president, is word salad. There's an old saying, and it's mildly crude, and I'm not going to repeat it as it's repeated, but you'll get the idea. If you can't dazzle with brilliance, you baffle with another substance. Many of you have heard that. If you don't know what it is, you can send me an email privately, and I will explain it to you. It's chairman@principledpolicy.com, chairman@principledpolicy.com. That's my email. And by the way, this is our show for August 17th, 2024, and I'm recording it on Friday the 16th. I did an interview with Mike O'Reilly. If you don't know this, Mike O'Reilly at WLRY does a show called Talk of the Town. And I am the guest when I remember to call in, which is an issue. I was actually late this week. So if you tuned in, you actually heard me talk for half an hour, but I didn't start till 8:15 because I messed Mike up and my alarm did not go off warning me that I had to call into the station. And I caught it about 13 or 14 minutes in. Mike said, okay, this will clear in a minute and we can go through. I thought I was going to get 15 minutes. Mike kept me for the whole half hour, which he can do because he's the boss over there. He's the program director and he runs the program. But Talk of the Town, and I am the guest every third Thursday. And Mike, I swear I'm going to have Mike come on here and ask me questions one day. Because Mike asks very good questions. And by the way, the question that he asked me that's prompting today's show came from his wife, Kelly. So thank you, Kelly, for being involved in alerting me to something that I don't necessarily have my finger on the pulse of as much as I used to. And why is that? Because my best friend, Barry Sheets, passed away a year ago, July 2nd. As many of you are well aware, and Barry Sheets was heavily involved. Barry kept me informed about things that were going on. In fact, I paid him as my company's lobbyist, and part of his job was to keep me informed, and he did anybody who had Barry's client knows he did a great job. Okay, so what am I talking about? Well, Kelly had Mike ask me a question regarding a ballot initiative, the Citizens Redistricting Commission initiative. And I'm guessing that not a lot of you have heard about this. And in fact, I hadn't heard about this, surprisingly. There's not a whole lot of organized opposition to this thing. And there should be, because this initiative, I'm going to be quite honest. I mean, I'm partisan. I'm not going to kid you. This initiative is awful. It's terrible. What do I mean by that? I mean, it creates a horrible mess. And I suppose I should give you some background on what all is happening. And I think that's a fair place to start. In the past, and we'll listen to what some of the proponents of these things have to say. In the past, states have always had control over how congressional districts are drawn based upon the last census. So our last census was in 2020, and the one before that was in 2010. What do you do when you get the results of the census? Okay, first of all, Congress writes a law basically reapportioning the number of representatives that a state can have based on population. So just so you get the picture, currently we have 435 representatives, and that number has been set by law. So, in other words, it's been frozen at 435. So how and why was the number of representatives set at 435? Well, because every 10 years, we have to reapportion the number of seats based on population of the individual states. Up until 1929, every 10 years, Congress would sit down and decide how many representatives there needed to be in Congress. Why would they debate changing the number of representatives? Basically, to spread out the political power, hopefully to get some kind of an advantage. So there, don't kid yourself. The parties always try to figure out a way to get a political advantage, right? You just can't get away from that. It's a part of human nature. Now, remember that at certain points in our history, the parties were much closer together than, for instance, they are now, than they were in the 1850s and 1860s. There are other periods, probably during the early 1900s, there were big party splits about the time that the Democrats and Republicans switched positions. And what do I mean by that? Until 1912, the Democrats were considered the conservatives and the Republicans were considered the radical progressives. And you'll see that in candidates like Robert La Follette, who was a Wisconsin progressive. Teddy Roosevelt was a progressive. People, for some reason, think that Teddy was some kind of a conservative. The good Roosevelt, they call him. No, he was every bit as bad as his cousin, Franklin. We have many bad things that came out of Teddy. Okay, that being said, they locked it at 435 to stop these incessant every 10-year debates on how many people should be in Congress. Now, in 1929, when it was capped, the population was significantly smaller than it is now. In 1929, the population was 130 million, and today we're at 330 million. So we're 2.5 times larger now than we were then, and yet we still have 435 representatives. Well, there is a constitutional provision for the number of representatives that you can set. And a lot of people have really grossly misinterpreted this. Remember, I've taught the Constitution many, many, many times. And I've debated this question with a lot of people. Let's go to the Constitution, Article 1, Section 2. This has to do with how we choose the number of representatives, a lot of other things. Okay. Now, it also lays out, by the way, what the first Congress, how many representatives each and every state got for the first Congress, knowing full well that after the first census, this would probably change. So if you try to argue that the 13 states get only this many for the life of the Republic, that's absurd. And because the Constitution makes that clear. Okay, here is the text of the Constitution. All right, this is Article 1, Section 2, Paragraph 1, 2, 3. All right, quote, representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union. By the way, did you notice taxes? Remember, folks, that until 1913, well, there was an income tax that got passed and it was found unconstitutional during the Civil War. Until 1913, you could not be taxed directly by the federal government. Taxes were apportioned by the states. The states were supposed to collect a tax from you in whatever way that your elected representatives, and that becomes important later on, your elected representatives at the state level decided. Okay? So that's an important clause. Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers, in other words, their population, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons. Yes, folks, unfortunately, free persons were counted as one, including those bound to service for a term of years and excluding Indians not taxed. Why were Indians not taxed? Because they were actually, in effect, considered a separate people and a separate nation. So in other words, when they were set up, Indians were not included in citizenship. They had their own citizenship and the way they ran their own governments. Okay? Three-fifths of all other people, this is the dreaded three-fifths clause, and I will tell you right up front, you'll hear the argument, and again, I'll go to, you know, Proverbs 10, where there's an abundance of words, sin abounds, that's one way of putting it, paraphrase there. Blacks were only counted as three, were only thought to be three-fifths of a person. You know who got the three-fifths clause through? It was not the South. In the compromise, it was the northern non-slaveholding states. The northern non-slaveholding states didn't want to count slaves as even three-fifths of a person. They wanted them counted like Indians, that is, not at all. The South demanded that they be counted as a single person, a one person, for the purposes of representation. Meaning what? The South was small population of free person states. They wanted their slaves counted as one. The North wanted them counted as zero. Well, did slaves have access to representation? No, not really. No. But this was a compromise. Three-fifths of a person for the purpose of counting the number of representatives. It was a terrible, terrible compromise. And they did attempt to free slaves. And what they got was the prohibition of the slave trade after 20 years, which put it at 1808, which was immediately done. When I say slave trade, I mean importing slaves was banned after 1808. And thank God for that. So slaves were traded internally, not externally. Okay. That's not where we're going with this. Well, this is going back to the Constitution. The actual enumeration shall be made within 3 years after the first meeting of the Congress of the United States and within every subsequent term of 10 years in such manner as they shall by law direct. So in other words, they wanted a count of the population within 3 years of the Constitution taking effect. And remember, that took effect in 1789. Yeah, now remember, it says within 3 years they'll have the first census. Well, when did they do the first census? Beginning in 1790. The U.S. Census Bureau was founded in 1790, and they began counting in August of 1790. Now, don't kid yourself. This was a big republic that, at the time, didn't have lots of roads, didn't have telegraph lines, didn't have telephone lines, didn't have radio, didn't have easy ways of getting from one place to another. So it took a while to do the population count, which is fine. As soon as they had the data, then they could reapportion by law. And remember, it says in here that Congress shall conduct the census by as the law shall direct. Who sets the laws? Congress does. The number of representatives, and this is important, this is the important part I want to get to. All the other stuff was fluff, but you need to know it to understand, to get a background on what we're going to talk about. The number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 30,000, but each state shall have at least one representative, and until such enumeration shall be made, then it goes into how many representative each state gets until such time as they count the population and reapportion the number of representatives to each state. So it goes through all of them and gives the number. That's an important consideration. It has to be done by law. It has to be done according to a proportion. In other words, there is a minimum of one representative, and it shall not exceed one for every 30,000. Now, I've had people that have argued with me that that means that it required one per 30,000, that that was a requirement. Listen to the language very closely. The number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 30,000, but each state shall have at least one. So in other words, it shall not exceed. In other words, you can't cut the number. You can't say, no, we want to appoint a representative for two, one for 15,000 and another for 15,000 if you've got a 30,000 population. You can't do that. Minimum 30,000 per. Okay. Now, ask yourself, if we stuck to that 30,000 ratio and demanded that Congress have as many representatives, you know, if we write that in concrete and say, no, it has to be one per 30,000, how many members of the House of Representatives would we have if we stuck with that ratio? Well, the answer might surprise you. It would be 11,000. We would have 11,000 members of the House of Representatives. Where would Congress meet, most likely? At 11,000 representatives, Congress would have to meet, for instance, in a professional basketball stadium. Would that be an unruly gathering? Oh, you and I both know it would essentially be ungovernable. You could not in today's, especially and in the 1850s, remember, we went through periods in our history where there were fist fights on the floor of Congress. People drew pistols on the floor of Congress and challenged one another to duels. In one case, a U.S. senator was accosted in the Senate chamber by a member of the House of Representatives who beat him unconscious and into a brain damage with a stick, a walking stick. Charles Sumner was the senator's name. The congressman was a guy named Preston Brooks, who essentially was challenging him to a duel. And when Sumner tried to get out of his chair to respond while this man was beating him with a cane, and I mean to the point where his seat, which was bolted to the floor, he had tried to get out of his seat so vigorously that it tore the bolts out of the floor. So Sumner was never exactly right after that. And the beef seems to be that Charles Sumner had insulted in the Senate chamber a relative of Brooks who served, I think, South Carolina, I think. I'm going back in the Wayback Machine. Okay, so this is the kind of thing that went on, and there were 236 members of the House in 1856 when this beating took place. It's by no means the only place. There were people challenged each other to duels and that kind of thing for things said on the floor of the House. They didn't necessarily challenge them to do it on the floor of the House. They wanted to do it because in most places, dueling was illegal. So they wanted to do it out in private in some field, someplace. Nonetheless, those kind of feelings have always run high. And if they run that high with 236 representatives, as they can run high now, although there are rules for maintenance of decorum, which the parliamentarian and the Speaker of the House attempt to maintain and will censure members, believe it or not, just as a sidebar, Preston Brooks was not removed from his seat. There was an attempt to remove him from his seat for this horrible thing. Charles Sumner was essentially an invalid for 3 years after this and was never really right when he came back to the Senate. He was from Massachusetts, as I recall. But Charles Sumner, there was an attempt to remove him, and it was voted down. So Charles Sumner kept his seat, but he said, okay, I'm going to put myself up in front of my constituents, a rare thing these days. As a matter of, he realized that there were controversies around what he had done. So Preston Brooks resigned his seat and ran in a special election for re-election to put the question to his constituents. Can you imagine a congressman today quitting his seat and running for re-election to turn the thing, his possible removal from the House, over to his constituents? Well, guess what his constituents did? They re-elected him, to show you how really regional animosities were. So they re-elected him. And believe it or not, he would have taken office in March of 1857, and he died 6 weeks before his term would have started. So that was the end of Preston Brooks. Sumner was out of the Senate for 3 years, recovering from this horrible head wound. And as I've said, he came back to his seat, and he did continue to serve in the Senate, but he was not quite the same. It was a horrible thing. Okay, enough of the history. 30,000, the number was 30,000 minimum. So, in other words, you could have more than one per 30,000. So, well, as it stands now, if any of you, I'm going to give you, I won't be able to judge this. How many people do you think are now served by a single congressman? It is way more than you might think. All right. If I told you that it was one congressman for 760,000 people, let me ask you a question. Do you think that that is true representation? Now, I personally do not. I have long been a proponent of an expanded number of congressional seats. And I've had people, conservative people, say, are you insane? You know, it's bad enough with the 435. And I go, I don't think you understand. You would actually dilute that number and reduce the power of each individual congressman. You would dilute it back to the constituents by increasing the number of representatives. All right. I have always thought that 1,100 would be a good number. I said be somewhere between 1,000 and 1,200. So what would 1,100 do to the numbers of people being represented? Remember, we used the math earlier. Okay, you do a quick math. 330 million people divided by 1,100 gives you about 300,000 constituents per representative. Seriously diluting the power of very powerful congressmen who represent 760,000 people. What does it also do? It increases the number of representatives that each state would get. Now, what does that do? Because you've got kind of apportionment rules, again, the federal government cannot set anything but the number. Now, we've had federal courts step in and say, no, you have to. This is how we get stupid things like what they call shoestring districts. When the federal courts get in and gerrymander districts, which have been done for decades, since at least the 60s, to try to racially divide up the seats. And, for instance, create districts where certain ethnic groups would have majorities. Well, to do that, to get the right number of people in a district, they'll do a shoestring district where there's a big blob at one end and a big blob at the other and something three or four blocks wide that connect them for miles. Why? To jam those into a single congressional district. Okay. Well, that being said, though, if you go up to 1,100, would it be unwieldy? It's getting to the point where it's too much. I would agree with you with that. However, it would slow things down. I have no trouble with slowing Congress down. That would be a goal that would be completely acceptable to me. I don't want to stop it. I don't want it to fall into chaos, which is, if it was constructed properly, you could reset the number of congressmen by law at 1,100. Now, remember something. We talked about how many representatives. Remember, 1929 was when it got frozen at 435. What was the population in the United States in 1929? Well, we can estimate based on the 1930 census, which is the next year. I think I said 130 million before. It's actually 123 million was the 1930 census. So in 1929, each representative represented about 280,500 people. Now, if you go back and look at my number, I said under the current population, if we went to 1,100, each representative would represent about 300,000 people. So this is actually the 1929 Congress had fewer people being represented. And honestly, fewer people means better response. So this show isn't really about my proposed changes to the House of Representatives at all. But it's to illustrate that these things are constitutionally warranted. They're constitutionally constructed. And it's all done by law, by elected representatives. Elected representatives is the most important part of this. It's not done by a commission. It's not done by a blue ribbon panel. It's not done by a group of experts. It's done by, now those people will be consulted, obviously. It was done by elected representatives. Okay, what's the big deal on that? What's the big deal on elected representatives and changing the way we are represented? Because representation is the biggest part of this, if that makes sense. Representation is by far the biggest part of this. We now have a proposal, and I'm going to go back in time a little bit, because there was, in 2015, and I remember Barry and I fought this tooth and toenail, and it passed anyway, big shock. Because the Supreme Court kept coming out and saying all these congressional districts are unconstitutional, unconstitutional, unconstitutional. Maureen O'Connor was a big player in that. The courts have never been given jurisdiction over how congressional districts are to be drawn in the state of Ohio. That's the legislature. How they determined they were unconstitutional, they basically determined that the Republicans who were in the legislature had not done enough to balance out the way the districts were proportioned on based on party. Well, now hold on for a minute. Since the beginning of the Republic, since Ohio has been a state, the state legislature, the redistricting based on the number of representatives that Congress says we can have based on the census has been decided by the party in power. Yes, with input from the minority party, but the party in power has decided how the districts get apportioned. Now, does that mean that the party in power gives itself an advantage, it thinks, in the upcoming congressional elections? The answer is obviously yes. Does it always work out? And the answer to that is, of course it doesn't always work out. Let me tell you something. Ohio, now a relatively reliable red state, has not always been that way. When I first started voting in the 1970s, Ohio would have been, this is before that designation, because that was came in the election of 2000, the presidential election. For some reason, red was chosen for Republicans and blue for Democrats. That's how we got red-blue. But Ohio would have been a fairly reliable blue state, at least as far as, for instance, the governorship. Take it back. Ohio was a purple state. And what is a purple state? It's a mixture of red and blue. But the legislature in Ohio was democratically controlled for decades, just like the U.S. Congress was democratically controlled from the mid-1950s until the 1980s, 30-plus years. Okay? So Democrats consistently reapportioned congressional districts to favor Democrats. And if they say they didn't, they're liars. So what has happened in Ohio? Ohio has shifted to being a more red state. Well, what does that do to the people who used to be in power and remember when they were in power and liked it when they were in power? What would they want to do? They would like to figure out a way to wrest control from the elected representatives. They definitely don't like the idea that the Republicans continue to redistrict. And so they continually sued. The Democratic Party would go to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court would come out and say it's unconstitutional. And they go back and redraw it. And they'd say it's still unconstitutional. And what they really meant was it wasn't equally proportioned between Republicans and Democrats, which you can't do because there are more registered Republicans in this state than there are Democrats. So how do you equally apportion it? Well, what you do, what they wanted done was to, under the guise of stopping gerrymandering, they wanted to do gerrymander districts. They wanted these weird, oddly shaped congressional districts. They did the same thing with state representation districts. So in order to, quote unquote, remove the politics from the process, quote unquote, to remove the politics. Folks, it's not to remove the politics. We'll discuss that in a minute. All right, what did we do? Somebody got a ballot initiative in 2015, and that someone was the Republican-controlled legislature, and they got on the ballot and initiate what they call an initiated constitutional amendment, which means that the legislature put it on the ballot and it was approved. What did it do? It created a 7-member commission, took reapportionment out of the hands of elected representatives, where it should be, in my opinion, this is why we oppose this. It took it out of the hands of elected representatives, and it places it in the hands of an unelected bureaucracy. Now the way the legislature had set up the system, it had a 5-member panel. And that, they make a big deal out of that. They had a 5-member panel that was a partisan 5-member board that included the governor, the state auditor, secretary of state, and 2 members selected by the legislative leaders of 2 major parties to draw legislative districts. In other words, there was one member of the minority party. Or if we have mixed government, which we've had in the past, in other words, the governor, the state auditor, or secretary of state are not necessarily of the same party. So if they got elected, we've had that in a recent past, by the way, the governor, state auditor, secretary of state, 2 members selected by the legislative leaders of the 2 major parties to draw legislative districts. In other words, basically one member of the opposition party, if it's not, so the legislative leaders, the Republicans would appoint one and the Democrats would appoint one. Now, the new commission that went into effect in 2015, the members are now the governor, the state auditor, the secretary of state, and 1 person appointed by the House of Representatives and 1 appointed by the legislative leader of the largest political party in the House, of which is, the speaker is not a member. 1 person. Look, realistically, if the speaker's a Republican, he has to appoint a Democrat. And 1 now by the Ohio Senate, and 1 person, the leader of the president of the Ohio Senate and the minority leader of the Senate get to appoint 1. So the number went to 2 if we don't have mixed government. Remember, governor, state auditor, secretary of state. If the secretary of state gets elected and he's a Democrat, then suddenly they have 3 members. Now, the new commission required 2 members from the minority party or 29% of the commission seats versus a single member under the former system. Does that mean that the boundaries they draw are necessarily it? No, it has to be passed by the legislature. both houses. So if you've got a split house, and again, a split legislature, one party Democrat, one party Republican, you got to go back and fight it out if it's too partisan. So one of the goofy things in the law, basically the amendment forbids district plans from favoring or disfavoring either political party. Folks, if you believe that, I know people that have some land most in a swamp that they would like you very much to take a look at. This is snake oil. The amendment forbids district plans from favoring or disfavoring either political party. Come on, who is kidding who? Now, is this commission better? No, it's not better. But at least it has a little bit more minority representation, minority party. Okay, this was not good enough. Basically taking it out of the hands of the legislature, who could decide how the commission was set up anytime they wanted to by law, took it out of their hands and wants to place it. The original law placed it into this commission, this magic commission that was supposed to do everything the way the parties wanted it. We need to go back and take a look at an initiative that's on the Ohio ballot this year. It's called the Citizens Redistricting Commission Initiative. Okay, it sounds pretty. And let's go back to Proverbs 18. I'm going to quote some biblical verses here. Chapter 10, verses 18 through 20. This is from the ESV. The one who conceals hatred has lying lips, and whoever utters slander is a fool. When words are many, transgression is not lacking, but whoever restrains his lips is prudent. The tongue of the righteous is choice silver. The heart of the wicked is of little worth. Now, what's that have to do with this? Well, there's a lie in the name. The Citizens Redistricting Commission Initiative. Now, this is an initiative. It's what's called a citizens initiative. What does that mean? It means that they gathered signatures. They got it on the ballot outside of the legislative process. How did they do that? Well, you may have been asked to sign one. Now, I know I did not get to ask to sign one, but I would have refused to sign this thing because it's a nightmare. The origin was it's a citizen initiated, as I stated. What does it do? It sets up a 15-member non-politician commission responsible for adopting state legislative and congressional redistricting plans. Folks, again, I go back. When words are many, transgression is not lacking. Non-politician commission. Don't kid yourself. All right. 15 members. What would it... I'm looking at Ballotpedia, and I'm going to put a link. When I can finally start posting to the website again, it's a mess. I'm trying to fix it. It's driving me insane. Here's what Ballotpedia says. What would the ballot initiative change in Ohio? The citizen-initiated constitutional amendment would establish the Ohio Citizens Redistricting Commission, which would be responsible for adopting state legislative and congressional redistricting plans, the CRC, as it's called, the Citizens Redistricting Commission, would replace the Ohio Redistricting Commission established in 2015 for state legislative districts and the process established for congressional districts in 2018, based on that law, which was a mess. The commission would have 15 members, 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, and 5 individuals who are independents or members of other political parties. Okay, keep that in mind. Independents or members of other political parties. You think the Constitution Party is going to get a smell of being on the Congressional Redistricting Commission? The answer is absolutely not. Who's going to be on there? It'll be oddball Socialist Democrats of America, libertarians, who, by the way, are running a Marxist for president this year, Jill Stein. So lest you think the libertarians are actually libertarians, no, they've been co-opted by the Marxists. No, thank you. It might be independents of if you think an RFK supporter is going to get on that redistricting, I think that, again, more swampland for sale. The ballot measure would create a screening panel of 4 retired judges, 2 Republicans, and 2 Democrats to review and screen applicants interested in serving as members of the commission. Uh-oh, red flag. Who appoints the Democrats? Who appoints the Republicans? And who for sure appoints the retired judges? This idea that retired judges somehow are nonpartisan is insane. It honestly is insane. Somehow they're more fair-minded. My gosh, one of the big supporters of this is Marino Sullivan, a former Supreme Court justice who was a gadfly. Essentially ran as a Republican and continually flew in the face of anything, any kind of conservative law or initiative. Arguments of non-constitutionality of things that are explicitly permitted or forbidden in the Constitution. The screening panel would be required to consider commission applicants' qualification, conflicts of interest, party affiliation, relevant experiences and skills, community ties, and commitment to impartiality, compromise, and fairness. Okay, folks, this is going to be a panel of experts. Who's going to get on this panel? College professors, activists of all stripes, people who are involved in all kinds of sketchy. Do you really think that conservative groups are going to be allowed to sit on the on this Congressional Redistricting Commission? The answer is absolutely not. And look who appoints the members. The members appoint themselves. The members appoint themselves. That would require the commission's actions and deliberations to be conducted in public meetings. Okay, fine. Where would those meetings be? In Columbus. So if you're from Toledo or from Cincinnati or from Gallipolis or from Youngstown or somewhere in rural, you'll have to go to Columbus for a public meeting. Actions would require the affirmative vote of at least 9 of 15 commissioners. Okay, math, 60%. By the way, as you'll recall, many of us, the special election of last August, not this last August, but a year ago, August 2023, we tried to get the Constitution changed to require any constitutional change would require a 60% vote. What did the opponents immediately say? Oh, you're ripping away the majority's rights. You're denying the majority a right to do what they need to do with the Constitution. Okay, so is requiring a supermajority on this commission not ripping away the rights of the majority? Requiring a supermajority? Oh gosh. Well, again, I'll go back. When words are many, transgression is not lacking. Okay, that must include. Okay, these 15 commissioners, 9 of the 15, the 9 must include 2 Republicans, 2 Democrats, and 2 Independents. So if you get 60%, but you don't get those proportions, what happens then? The ballot measure would require that no later than September 19th, 2025, and by July 15th of every year ending in 1, so in other words, 2021, 2031, 2041, obviously 2021 won't count, but starting with 2031 and so on, the commission must adopt final redistricting plans. The ballot measure would require the statewide proportion of districts that favors each political party shall correspond closely to the statewide partisan preferences of the voters of Ohio. Districts would be required to be contiguous. Okay, fine. That's what the earlier proposal did. In other words, contiguous. They have to be all connected. We talked about shoestring districts. That's a connection. And in compliance with the U.S. Constitution and federal laws, including the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So, in other words, you can't redistrict to keep blacks from voting. Now, the laws didn't do that before. It may have disenfranchised them insofar as they couldn't get their own congressional districts, but who says that congressional districts should be handed out on the basis of race? Okay, going on. Commissioners would also be required to consider communities of interest and the ability of politically cohesive and geographically proximate racial, ethnic, and language minorities to participate in political process and to elect candidates of choice. So in other words, you can't violate the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, but you can gerrymander in other ways to keep specific special interest groups in one district or multiple districts. And let me read that again. Commissioners would also be required to consider communities of interest. What does that mean? Communities of interest. Could it mean socialist enclaves, which there are very often, for instance, university districts are communities of interest because they have an interest in extending socialism. The ability of, quote, politically cohesive and geographically proximate racial, ethnic, and language minorities to participate in the political process and to elect candidates of choice. Okay, who says that minority groups or politically cohesive and geographically proximate racial, ethnic, and language minorities. What is meant by that? It means people who are, I'll be quite honest, now, not necessarily, but that includes a lot of illegals, because what are we doing rapidly right now? We are quickly signing illegals up to vote. I've been in a Bureau of Motor Vehicles when it happened. Here's the question they get asked. Are you a citizen? And the answer is yes. Would you like to register to vote? They don't ask them to see a birth certificate. They don't ask them to see citizenship papers if they're naturalized. And this guy clearly would have had to have been naturalized. He said he just got in from Mexico a few weeks before. Okay. This is an attempt to cram as many illegals and people who should not be allowed to vote into the voting rolls as possible and into specific districts to concentrate power. All right? This is would be a requirement of this board if this thing passes. Now, there's a lot of stuff in here about how Ohio would compare if we passed it to other states. Well, I can give you some bad players, Colorado and Michigan. There are these so-called non-political commissions. Now, most states, like 34, have quote-unquote politician-dominated redistricting methods, which means, in other words, that elected representatives, not appointed people who are then perpetuated by the members of the commission themselves, in other words, unelected. And unelected means unresponsive. We just had a long discussion of how too many people under a representative can mean a lack of responsiveness to the other people in the district. That's why I brought all that up and gave all the history. But the fact is that this has been tried before in Ohio. It has failed, and it should fail this time. Now, we can look at who's behind this. I'm going to run out of time before I get to the meat of this. Okay, the group that is pushing this is called Citizens Not Politicians. Okay, that's fine. Who are they? Supporters of Citizens Not Politicians are a lot of people, a lot of radicals. Nikki Antonio, Senate Minority Leader, House Minority Leader Allison Russo, State Representative Mike Curtin, again, another radical, Ohio Supreme Court Justice Yvette McGee Brown, the first Democrat elected to that in decades, honestly, former Ohio State, this is who I was talking about before, Ohio Supreme Court Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor, who is a radical. Now, who else? The AFL-CIO, American Federation of Teachers. Why is a teachers union interested in redistricting? National Education Association. Why is a national teachers union interested in Ohio redistricting? Ohio Education Association. Why is another Ohio teachers union interested in Ohio redistricting? Ohio Federation of Teachers. Again, ditto. The SEIU, Ohio State Joint Council. That's the state employees union. Why are they interested in Ohio redistricting? Except perhaps to have a stronger influence on elections. Other places. Now, there's a list here. Some of them I can't follow. Can't find anything. There's a group called Article 4. The only thing I can find is article4.org, and it has nothing. Their website says there will be more after the convention. Well, what convention? I'm assuming the Democratic convention. Equality Ohio, another radical group. There's a group on here, on the whole list. There's a big, giant list. Some of them more radical than others. You may think some of these aren't particularly radical. They are. But the Democracy Fund, America Votes, Abortion Forward. Why would abortion providers want basically to have anything to do with redistricting? Or not abortion provider, but abortion advocates. Why would they want to do that? Well, the answer is, should be obvious, I would hope. Here's one that, of course, Planned Parenthood Advocates of Ohio are involved, want to be involved in. You don't think that somebody from Planned Parenthood isn't going to end up sitting on this redistricting panel? Come on. Again, more swampland for you to buy. Ohio Progressive Collaborative. The Open Society Policy Center, folks. Who is the Open Society Policy Center? That's George Soros. Our American Future Foundation. There's a group called Represent.us who basically are proponents of really odd and really bad voting methods like ranked choice voting. We're going to end gerrymandering. And what they mean is they're going to end basically elected representatives' ability to set congressional districts. So what are they doing? They're trying to rip it out of the hands of the elected and put it in the hands of blue ribbon panels, which is what this election commission is. It's a blue ribbon panel. And what do I mean by that? I think you know what I mean by that. It is, again, a group of experts who are going to give a report. All right. One thing I found was something called the 1630 Fund. And I did a little looking into the 1630 Fund. And it is a left-wing dominated. And this is according to Wikipedia, not exactly a conservative bulwark. According to Wikipedia, it is a left-wing dark money group. And when Wikipedia calls calls it a dark money group. By the way, I'll put that in the links as well if I ever get post again on the website. It's a hub of, this is from Wikipedia. The 1630 Fund is a hub of undisclosed political spending, quote-unquote dark money, on the American left. The group serves as a fiscal sponsor for other organizations incubating and financing various progressive projects. According to the New York Times, the 1630 is part of a broader network of progressive nonprofits that that donors use to fill specific spaces on the political chessboard. Don't you love that, New York Times? Thank you. In other words, they're a left-wing dark money influence group. The 1630 Fund is administered by Arabella Advisors, which is a non-profit consulting group. The 1630 Fund is a 501c4, which means it's a tax-exempt education organization. Even Politico, which again is not exactly a Republican bulwark, has called it a left-leaning secret money group. Basically, it's saying how, you know, it's giving it as an example of how much the left embraced the you know, the things that Republicans were supposedly doing. And I'm laughing. I'm like, there's been foundation money, the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, now the Gates Foundation, pouring into left-wing coffers for decades. The 1630 Fund has a lot of money, $389 million, almost $390 million. In 2020, that was their budget. Billionaires George Soros and Pierre Omidyar, who was one of the founders of PayPal, I think, have disclosed multi-million dollar donations to the group. They have given money to try to undermine Brett Kavanaugh, other Donald Trump judicial nominees. They've given lots and lots of money to the politicians in those states who were serving as opposition to that. Swiss billionaire Hans-Jörg Wyss has donated $245 million to the 1630 Fund since 2016. The fund gives directly to political committees and pays for TV ads that back specific candidates and causes. In 2022, the FEC said 1630 funds should be required to register as a political committee, which would require more disclosure. Yeah, because they're very undisclosive, if that's a word. So, look, folks, I've just kind of laid out what's wrong. I spent probably too much time laying out the history of how congressional redistricting has taken place, representation, and here we are. The Tides Foundation, by the way, is another one of these groups. The Tides Foundation, another group, Tides Foundation, that has received tons of money from George Soros. Okay, what's wrong with the picture when all these progressives, and by progressives I mean Marxists, who want to have a profound effect on the congressional picture coming out, especially Ohio. They'd love to win Ohio. Why? Because Ohio's reliably red and reliably conservative, and they really want to move it into the progressive socialist column. And there are enclaves of that in Ohio. I would say the big cities, Toledo, Dayton, Columbus, Cleveland, Youngstown, Cincinnati, very far left. But they don't dominate because Ohio's population is so equally spread out between rural and city, those places can't dominate so easily. So that being said, I urge you to vote no on this initiative. The initiative to establish the Citizens Redistricting Commission. Vote no. I think it's issue one. I'm pretty sure it's issue one. And that being the case, please vote no on this. And if you have questions, get a hold of me at my email address, chairman@principledpolicy.com. That's chairman@principledpolicy.com. And you know what I think. I want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. And that's www.principledpolicy.com. And join me again next week for another Principles and Policies.